All right, so we interviewed Dan DeWeese. Now, Dan is a name that I feel like I ran across his name so many times just living in Portland, but I never met him. And I heard about him probably mostly because he runs Propeller Books, and I know Wendy and some other people that write for Propeller, the online magazine, and have been published by their book, what do you say it? The
Division.
book division arm, whatever. But it was cool to meet him. I didn't expect him to be so tall.
I don't think he's that tall.
I thought he was tall when he was
Well,
here.
you're, but see, you have like a weird tall man's, because you yourself are somewhat tall, but you think everyone, you're like 5'11 and you say you're 5'10,
I
which
think
is
I
the
am
opposite.
5'10.
But I'm 6 feet.
Really?
Yeah, and I think he's frankly probably my height. I don't think
Oh.
he's any taller. Well,
Oh, I take
maybe
it
he
back.
is. We should have, I don't know if we talked about his height.
Let me check celebsheight.com. Hold on.
What's it say?
I'm just kidding.
I see. Oh, really? But so yeah, I had Dan as a teacher at Portland State, I mean, a decade ago, and his class actually kind of opened my eyes, as we discussed in the interview, about kind of taking an academic route in terms of kind of, a profession versus still involving academics, but also doing things like, events and like things like Propeller and the stuff that I kind of do that still maybe doesn't pay the bills exactly, but also keeps you involved in a community. So it was good to talk to him. And he also, I saw him, or I don't know if I saw him, but years ago we were at the same show at the Roseland, which is the worst music venue in Portland. But we saw the band The Walkmen play, and Father John Misty opened. And he, I mean, this is probably 2014, yeah. And so I don't know if we were really in contact that much then, but I do know he went to that show, and it was a fine show. Although, again, I don't like the Roseland.
No, nobody likes the Roseland.
He's into music, though. He's a big film guy too. But it was also interesting the songs that we talked about here, because we kind of crafted a narrative, and he kind of pushed back about some of my easy-minded fallacies and notions.
I don't remember that. I want to re-listen just to hear that.
We talked about Hunter S. Thompson, and I can't wait for us to both to listen.
I do want to say I appreciate that he really came with not only a playlist of songs to talk about, which most of our guests do, and it's always kind of frames the whole show. But what I like so much about his playlist is it the playlist in itself had kind of a narrative that became clear as we got to the end, why he had
Right.
chosen all of them.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, he's a novelist, so I guess beginning, middle, end. I've never written a novel. You have. Why don't you talk to that?
You need to have a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Ah, that's what he had. And then he also doesn't like Guns N' Roses.
Well, no, they're horrible.
Well, that's in his latest book. The main character doesn't like Guns, or I don't know if it's the main. I think it is. Doesn't like Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
Okay, that's another conversation.
DeWeese. Welcome to the steer. Is that good? Is that
Yeah,
a good
that's good.
intro?
That's really kind of like,
The good intonation?
well, I don't mean on the air, but I just mean in general, because, well, whatever. Yeah, let's do this.
Thanks for being here, Dan.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Did you see that Jerry Winogrand documentary?
No.
But do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know who that is, but I didn't know there was a documentary.
There was some type of documentary. I didn't see it either, but I wanted to. It's Cinema 21.
Oh, okay.
But I just read the essay on your website.
Yeah.
You like him?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How'd you get in? Would he could be considered a street photographer or
Yeah,
no?
I think so.
Okay,
Yeah.
because that
Because he
term.
fired off tons. He liked to, apparently, I mean, I'm not an expert, but apparently he liked to walk around and or be driven around and just firing off tons of shots. And the challenge with him is sorting through it.
But I mean, some photographers don't like that term, right?
Oh, I don't know. Is that true? They don't like being called a street photographer? Is that a,
Did I make
is
that
that
up in
a,
my mind?
no. I think we were talking about this before you showed up, Dan,
Okay.
and he
Oh, cool.
wasn't sure
So,
if he
so
could.
you guys prepped before and then you just sprung this on me. Okay. Yeah. Well, why don't you guys just go ahead then? Yeah.
No, he wasn't sure if he could call him a street photographer, and I said it's not a derogatory term.
I didn't I didn't think so, but no. Also I wouldn't pretend to know. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know that much about it. This is we're off to a great start.
This is fantastic. So three guys that know very little gathered in a room.
It's interesting. I mean, because your website has interviews on film, on culture, right?
Yeah.
And then...
Interviews or essays? Yeah.
Interviews, essays.
Sure.
Didn't you used to on your website have a thing on the Walkman?
Yes.
So your website's been changed?
I guess so.
Okay. I was just curious.
That's been a while ago. But yeah, for sure I did. I did an interview, an email interview once, I think, where I had to name a band who had been important to... I think that was back with my first novel. And yeah, I talked about the Walkman a little bit, for sure.
Okay. I just remembered that and I didn't see it on there this time.
Yeah.
So where are you from?
I'm from Colorado, Northern Colorado.
Where in Northern Colorado?
I grew up in a town called Loveland. Most people, I have to say, it's a small town south of Fort Collins. I have to say Fort Collins because people know Fort Collins because of the university there.
Sure.
Yeah.
And what did your parents do?
My dad was an engineer for Hewlett Packard, and my mom was at home when we were little, and then I think worked at a department store when we got a little bit older.
And growing up, a lot of culture in the house, or no? How'd you turn into who you are?
Yeah, let's do this quick. Let's just cut to the chase, because I can, you know, I'll answer that in a couple minutes, you know? Wacky coincidence, and then a couple of mistakes, and here I am. A lot of culture. I don't know. I mean, we had the standard thing. We had National Geographic magazine, and we got Newsweek, and we got a daily newspaper from a small town.
Did you get discounts at your mom's department store?
Yeah, she worked at a place that eventually the Macy's chain would buy. You know, there used to be like four or five different chains in the country, but yeah, I think so. Yeah.
It doesn't sound like it's a memory.
No.
I remember my mom taking me shopping to the department store, and I would always get a huge cup of soda with ice, and then it would chill my belly, and then I'd have cramps for the entire shopping session. And I didn't realize till I was older that that was the problem. I just thought shopping hurted.
Shopping gave you cramps.
Yeah, I hated it.
Huh. And later you decided it was the ice?
Yeah, and maybe I'm wrong, but that's what someone told me later. Like, oh, you were chilling your stomach. You're drinking too much icy, sugary drinks.
The department store my mom worked at, they didn't have concessions.
Oh.
So the whole thing was sidestepped, smartly, apparently.
Yeah, luckily for you.
But when did you start writing, though? I mean, because you didn't have any... Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have a younger sister.
Yeah. Okay, so I assume she didn't get you into writing.
No, just did it on my own.
Just...
Usual thing. I mean, I shouldn't say usual, but, you know, people say, oh, I always did it, and that's kind of true for me. I mean, when it's time for me to go off to college, I kind of wasn't sure what I should do, but I knew that I liked making short movies with my friends with our family's camcorder, and I'd done that quite a bit.
Yeah. In Loveland.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I would just grab the camcorder, which my parents had bought, you know, to record things in our childhood, as was done at the time.
Like the big ones.
Yeah. This is like an early one where, yeah, like on your shoulder. And there's a second unit that's hanging over your... from a shoulder belt, like, you know, like it's a two-piece thing. It's a big deal.
Okay.
But yeah, I was making I would use it to make goofy movies with my friends. And so then when it was time to choose a place to go to college, I thought, oh, I don't know, maybe I should study movies. And that's how I ended up going to film school. And that's when I left Colorado, because I went to film school in Los Angeles.
And were you writing screenplays in Loveland, or were you doing like treatments, or were you just...
No, I didn't do any screenwriting when I was in high school. I was just, I mean, when I was... younger, I wrote stories, you know, as most kids do, either as an assignment for a grade school class or just for fun. And I wrote for fun. I think in high school, I kind of just mostly wrote what you were supposed to write for your homework.
How did you like living in LA?
Well, I usually say, you know, that I lived in a rural area. So I lived outside of a small town in Colorado. So in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. And I went from there to South Central Los Angeles. And it was probably a little bit of a culture shock, not in any way where I was, you know, it was the total opposite. So it was a great education in terms of there, people live different ways in different places. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't super comfortable in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I lived there for a few years because I was trying to be a film composer, but I was wildly depressed. I hated living in L.A.,
After I graduated, I stayed in LA a couple more years, and I lived in West Hollywood, and that was a lot more fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because there were things to do in your neighborhood that you could get to? Is that what made it?
Yeah, fun? And there was the neighborhood was much more vibrant. I think West Hollywood is kind of like the one of the kind of gay capitals of Southern California.
Right.
So there were clubs, and it's not like I went into the clubs and participated a lot, but it was a very vibrant neighborhood that had cool stores, cool shops, all sorts of stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Were you at UCLA?
No, USC.
USC. Okay. And did that make you not want to write screenplays? Or
when I started out, I thought, as everyone does, oh, I think maybe I want to direct movies. And then the more I thought about that, the more that I thought, maybe I just want to write them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the more that I worked on screenplays, the more I thought, I really like writing, and screenwriters are not really in control of the product. And so I started writing fiction. And then that's when I knew that there was no reason for me to keep living in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that a big realization, though? I mean, was that hard to kind of...
It felt like it at the time. I mean, because I just finished this college degree in, and so I was supposed to become a person that works in the film industry.
Right.
And then within 2 years, I was like, I think I'm out of here. So it seemed big at the time. Of course, any older person would be like, oh, so you didn't end up using your undergraduate degree? I mean, that's pretty standard. But at the time, I guess you feel like it's a momentous decision. Maybe it's not really.
Yeah. I mean, I guess one of the reasons why I asked is I guess it was almost a decade ago now. I took a class from you writing for 14, 4, 5, 15, or what was that class? You know what I'm talking about?
You must have taken teaching and tutoring writing.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, I do remember, and I think I've written about this a tiny bit before, that like we had to kind of get out in the field, which we were interested in. So I was an intern at Literary Arts.
Oh, you were probably taking Writing Careers for English Majors or something like that.
Writing Careers for English Majors.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm sure that sounds...
Could have been teaching and tutoring writing too, though, because students in there also have to do it. But your listeners are not interested in the curriculum, the course numbers.
Well,
the course numbers.
They are.
You ended up interning somewhere.
Yeah, they are and they aren't. I mean, I guess one of the reasons why I bring it up is I still remember. I mean, that was a very formative class for me because up to that point, I mean, I went through school when I was younger and I kind of thought my mom was a teacher. My dad was an adjunct. And I always thought I was going to be teaching without really thinking about if I liked teaching.
Sure.
And kind of that class. And you said, well, I mean, you talked about kind of you run a writing center, you also teach, but that where you ended up wasn't necessarily where as an undergrad you thought you were going to end up.
Yeah. If we were talking about teaching, you must have been taking the course teaching and tutoring writing, which I teach once a year. I'm
going
to be teaching it in a few. Next month, yeah.
Okay, well, maybe I'll audit it.
No, you've already taken it.
Because I'm still lost. But I guess it just made me kind of, I mean, it kind of just is tangential to talking about not being in control of things in terms of screenwriters and what have you, that there are a lot of options in terms of wherever you kind of, you know, whatever you decide to do. And that was one of the things, like you run Propeller, which is an independent thing that you took your destiny into your own hands to a certain degree.
Sure.
Which for me, I just had, I guess, I had certain kind of ideas in my head that class kind of broke me out of.
In a good way? Or are you saying that I destroyed you?
No, in a good way. I mean, because
did you call me here in order to kind of call me to account for something that I did?
No, I think there's the reality.
I say a lot of stuff, Jeff.
I'm telling you, this is a positive experience. There's the reality of the thing, and then there's the idealization of the thing. And I guess at that younger age, and then I did teach a lot, and I guess I'm still a teacher, honestly. But it's just, it was important for me to know that there's other options and there's other ways of doing things other than the quote-unquote standard way.
Sure. Everybody has had teachers that they suspected the teacher didn't really like teaching.
And, have they?
haven't you at some point? Okay.
I guess. Well, yeah, then I worry.
No, I'm just trying to say that you meet people. It's not just teaching either. You meet people all the time that what they do for a living, they do not like.
Right.
And
yeah.
If if I'm teaching a course for college students where the choices are still open, and not just the choices that they make, but the way they mentally approach things is still something that's kind of open, then that seems like it's a good time to talk about what are the choices for what I do and what are the choices for how I approach what I do, as opposed to someone, you know, being 2 decades into a career that they don't like, and they feel like the options are limited for changing, right?
Yeah, I guess, yes. It's just hard sometimes coming to those crossroads and then making a decision that can ultimately, because I went through school for a long time and now I'm just coming to the realization that, you know, maybe I'm not, maybe I've known for a while, teaching isn't really my thing. But I mean, I have like a record label and I do other things
sure.
that are somewhat analogous, well, different than Propeller, but also I've kind of taken my
similar, yeah.
destiny into my own hands.
Right.
Which doesn't pay well right now, but, it's seeing things kind of what you've done that has been, I guess, important for me.
Oh, thanks.
We should just, because you've mentioned it a couple of times, say what Propeller is, if anyone doesn't know. You publish, how many books do you publish?
One a year. One a year.
And you also have the website with columns.
Maybe. Yeah, it started off as a website where it was just like, let's just make a magazine online. Mm-hmm. And then pretty quickly it was like, well, you know, it'd be fun to publish one title per year, mm-hmm. one actual hard copy book. And so both those things continue. Yeah, there's a website where people write reviews or essays, or we do interviews. And then the press does one book, one title per year.
And they're beautiful. I like.
Oh, thanks.
Not only obviously what's inside, but I always, it matters. It's maybe sounds superficial, but it matters so much to me how a book feels and looks on the outside.
Yeah.
I know it probably shouldn't, but it does. And your books always feel really nice. They have a good cover. They've got a good sort of weight and texture to them.
Thanks. Yeah. No, I think that's something that is definitely a goal. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It should matter, right? Shouldn't every aspect of the book matter?
Well, that's the old saying, don't judge it by a cover. But the cover, it's hard not to. It's like if you didn't put any thought in the cover, then how much?
Right.
I don't know.
Right. Yeah.
But we should get back to the, I thought it was an interesting point that we left on. You were in LA, you decided movies weren't for you, you wanted to write. And then you decide, I don't have to live in L.A. So where'd you go from there?
I thought, you know what? I'm going to, instead of what I'll do is I'll become a teacher. And I thought, I'll become a high school teacher. Mm-hmm. And so I did 2 years studying education. And my degree was in film. So if I wanted to become a high school English teacher, I had to go back to school and take a bunch of literature courses and stuff. So I did 2 years at Colorado State University.
Oh, so you went back to Colorado?
Yes.
Okay.
And I lived in Fort Collins for a couple of years. And then got my teaching certificate, but then got married and moved out here because of my wife's job. And then once I got out here, then ended up going back to school again to get a grad degree in creative writing.
At
PSU.
Okay.
You mentioned before we turned on the mics, we were talking about plays, and you mentioned seeing plays in New York. Did you live in New York, or do you just visit?
No, I've just, those were just visits.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you see any good shows in New York? Musical shows?
I don't think I've ever seen it. I went to a jazz club once and that was good. I can't remember who was playing, but sorry, no.
That's
no
fine. That's
no concerts.
And then, so you've been here ever since though?
Yeah. I've been here in Portland for, I mean, close to 19 years.
Oh, so since 2000?
Yeah.
So we should get to your list. Obviously, this show is about music. And I am curious, some of these, do you want to just read them, Sonny? And then we can kind of talk through them.
Well, how about if I just play the first one?
Sure. These are Dan's picks that we're going to...
I won't play the entire song, just a snippet. And
sounds fine.
And we'll go from there.
I got from hiding, I'm bound to keep on riding, and I got one more silver dollar, and I ain't gonna let 'em catch me, no, I ain't gonna let 'em catch the midnight rider.
Thank you.
So that's Midnight Rider by Willie Nelson. Are you a longtime Willie fan?
Not in like a serious Willie fan way like Jeff, but...
that's true.
Yeah. I was there as a kid for his broad appeal moment from the late 70s to the early 80s. He had a few albums that pretty much everybody listened to.
Like Stardust?
Is that yeah, the albums where he covered standards. Yeah, uh-huh. Stardust. But that track we just listened to is from the soundtrack to a film called The Electric Horseman,
okay.
Which had Robert Redford and Jane Fonda in it.
Uh-huh.
And made a deep impression on me. Yeah.
The movie or the...
Both.
Okay.
Yeah, both of them. And I just, you know, it's tricky because you guys are like, well, send us some music that is meaningful to you, I think is the phrase.
Yeah.
And it froze me for a while because I know the canon of things to suggest that are meaningful to me and that also are cool, right? So right. I should include some Talking Head stuff. There's a whole list you can do that's totally safe. But then I thought, don't do that. Do the Willie song. But yeah, that movie and that song, Willie Nelson is in it, by the way. Have you seen it, Jeff?
No.
Oh my God, you've got to see it.
Is it, what's it called?
Willie's so good in it. The Electric Horseman?
No, I haven't.
Oh, he's so good in it.
Okay.
Yeah, he's not in it a huge amount, but he's in there mostly early on, and he's fantastic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Electric Horseman.
Yeah, it's Willie Nelson and you know, Robert Redford sitting around in hotel rooms just drinking. I mean, and it's awesome. But
You saw this when you were younger.
I did see it when I was younger. I think I saw it at a drive-in theater with my parents.
Oh,
probably okay. I was sitting in the back of a station wagon or something.
Uh-huh.
But it is kind of the tail end. Like now I could put it in perspective and say that this movie that came out in 1980, or I think it came out in the end of 1979, is kind of the tail end and the kind of softening of that, of the, like the Easy Rider moment that's mm-hmm. late 60s where you get some real interesting oppositional films.
Mm-hmm.
And that stuff is really interesting and fascinating to me, but that's slightly, you know, I was not yet born when Easy Rider was out, but by the time I caught that strain, it had morphed into Robert Redford stealing a horse from a Vegas casino and riding it out into the country to try and rehabilitate it, and a movie with Jane Fonda as the female lead. So that's a kind of a commercial version of this energy that was around. So by the time you hit 1980, it's a little bit softened, but I thought it was awesome as sure. a little kid.
Yeah. Right. You were younger too.
Yeah.
Right?
I would have been six or seven,
right.
6 years old.
Okay.
But I still identified with the guy that's gonna go off on his own.
Oh, really?
And fix things. Yeah.
You can pinpoint that looking back that you still identify with the kind of loner?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Looking back, you know, at the time, I'm sure I was just like, oh, that was, you know. But looking back, I can see like, boy, even at six, I was like, that's the guy.
Interesting.
Right there. He walks right into a Vegas casino and rides the horse right out, right through all the machines, down the street and in and out into the West. And I immediately was like, yeah, that's the thing.
And did you know, do you remember thinking I got to get Willie Nelson music as well?
No, because my parents had, you know, had it.
Oh, they had it.
Yeah, okay. They got the soundtrack album. The soundtrack album's super weird. The first side is nothing but like really strange disco music. And then the other side is Willie Nelson songs.
Was it records or tapes?
They had the record.
When were tapes invented?
Probably right around then.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, do you think most people would have identified with that character? Or do you think that kind of was symbolic of kind of at a young age? You said looking back, but I mean, is that something that's a through line for you in your life? The outsider to a certain degree?
Oh, totally.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that movie is designed to appeal to that sentiment in the audience.
So you wouldn't have been the only one who would have identified.
No, the assumption is that people are going to, whatever Robert Redford says in this movie, people are going to be on his side.
Mm-hmm.
The movie has all sorts of like great character actors in it too, playing, you know, corporate executives who want that horse back because it's the, it's their corporate logo and this is embarrassing them. It's a pretty like standard template for like an anti-corporate movie. Mm-hmm. But it made a, I mean, I was six, so what did I didn't care that it was a standard template.
Have you rewatched it recently?
Oh, I watch it every few years.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And then have you introduced it to your own children?
Yeah, if you rewatch it, you have to be careful about which version you rent or whatever, because they lost the rights to the Willie Nelson songs at a certain point, and they replaced them in some DVD versions of the movie with kind of generic, like, jazzy music. Doesn't work at all.
Weird.
So you got to make sure you get the version that has the Willie Nelson songs in it.
Yeah, I've never heard of it. I always thought once a movie has something in it, that's it's done.
Right.
I didn't know they could lose rights.
Oh, well, totally.
Yeah, once in a while that happens, I think. Wow. Yeah.
Would you like to hear another song?
Sure. We got songs to get through here.
All right.
Well, we're also curious about your life, but yeah.
No, my life is not that interesting. The music's way more interesting.
We're using music to get to your life.
No, I'd rather not even get to my life. No.
All right. Here we go. So that was Have a Cigar by Pink Floyd.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Still pretty good.
Still good.
Why is that song pretty good?
You know, that song's the same thing, really. That's a song sung in a persona of a kind of record executive or A&R guy talking to someone in Pink Floyd and saying things that are crass.
Hmm.
So that's still a kind of anti-corporate vibe.
Anti-corporate vibe. Now, I mean, do you listen to lyrics? We only heard, what, 10 seconds of
normally
lyrics?
I don't listen to lyric in most music. I don't pay a huge amount of attention to lyrics, but I've heard that's, I mean, I've listened to that song hundreds of times. So, yeah, I mean, I know what that song's about.
Right. And you were introduced to it.
Also, sound, like, in terms of Pink Floyd, that's like the dark chocolate of the Pink Floyd catalog. You know, that's like a dessert treat that they give you when they're not going to do a 20-minute long Well, Space Jam, right?
Yeah. I mean,
it's like, here's a little candy for you. We know how to do this if you want it.
What album is that on?
We don't do it very often. Here's a little dessert track for you. That's on Wish You Were Here.
Wish You Were Here.
That's the album they put out right after Dark Side of the Moon.
Okay.
So Dark Side of the Moon makes them like super, super famous. It's one of the best-selling albums of all time. Mm-hmm. And the next album, you get some tracks where they're like, I mean, with that track, you get a track where they're like, well, people have started talking to us this way. You know?
Right. Because they're successful.
Yes. What else could we put out by you? And so they just turn that into a song where they just mock.
Right.
Yeah.
The first Pink Floyd album I bought was Uma Guma.
Oh, nice.
Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah. That's early stuff. Yeah.
I couldn't get into it.
No, of course. I mean, it's
I
hard.
Mean, I was probably 14.
Yeah, it's hard.
It was. So, I mean, this was still Syd Barrett. And then I got the Division Bell. Were you
wow,
big?
You just skipped. You just went from the early days to just like
well,
after it's over.
My friend Ross is really into Pink Floyd. And then he was a, I don't know, he was a completist. He was like, you got to start with the start, man. Like, so sure. I got those. And then I never got too into Pink Floyd.
Well, you know, I think that when I look at these things, both that Willie Nelson song and that song, I'm real suspicious of like generation narratives. I think every generation has a wide array of personalities.
Mm-hmm.
So you should probably take this with a grain of salt. But there are times where I think of how prevalent this was, this kind of thinking was, this kind of interest in the individual as a person who's able to resist the kind of norming mainstream consumerist push, and that there was a kind of bravado to maintaining a slight position slightly outside of the mainstream.
A positive bravado.
Absolutely. Okay. Yes, that if you're watching the Robert Redford movie, you're like, yeah, Redford's right, you know. Don't play the game.
Sure.
And if you're listening to Pink Floyd, then Pink Floyd is sending the same message, which is like, don't worry, we're not listening to these guys. But now that stuff maybe doesn't hold for those entities forever. But that was a real vibe when I was a kid. Yes, exactly. That was a real vibe when I was a kid.
Sure. Yeah. And one that you think is a generational vibe to a certain degree? That your generation got.
I mean, I guess that's what I was implying by trying to back away from that statement. But yeah, I think so. Yeah.
In a way that kids now, if you're 16 or 14, or well, I guess whenever you first heard that, don't necessarily, they're not getting that in their heads, selling out. I mean, it's a different world, obviously.
It's a totally different world.
Yeah.
The kids now, I think, are just fine and they're doing great. Right. But they have a totally different, field in front of them.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's an interesting thing. I saw the band Jawbreaker play last year at the Crystal Ballroom, and they were famously. I mean, it's, you know that band?
I know who they are. I haven't really listened to them.
Well, Green Day hit, and they were in the same kind of scene as Green Day, and they were supposed to kind of be the next Green Day, and they had one, and they were always famously, I'm never going to sell out.
Yeah.
And then they had one album on David Geffen's label. What was that called?
DreamWorks?
I think so.
Yeah.
The album was called Dear You, and it flopped, and then they broke up, and then 20 years later, they reunited, and tickets were $50 at the Crystal Ballroom.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that good a show. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's interesting, too, like, if you don't take such a purist stance at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
how things can kind of pan out, I guess. Because they were famously, like, we will not signed to a major label, and then they did,
mm-hmm.
and then it fizzled fairly quickly, and then I don't know, I guess I do kind of wonder.
And I think it's when I look back at this stuff, when I try and say, okay, so why Midnight Rider and why that Pink Floyd track, and I mean, you got to be careful with this kind of male bravado, because it can curdle very quickly into a kind of, I don't know, it's like two neighborhoods over from toxic masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every abusive male coach or whatever thinks that they're an individual leading a tribe of young men to victory in this, you know, whatever, this at this wrestling meet or whatever. Like plenty of people think that they are the individual with insight who's not going to be pulled into the norm because they're going to live a life of excellence and truth. I mean, you got to be careful with that.
Yeah.
Because you think it's just self-absorption that can turn into corrosiveness?
Well, I was going to say there's a first step before self-absorption, but if you think it's already self-absorbed, then there's the problem, right?
Well, I don't.
Sure, totally.
I mean, so there's a danger of too much individuality.
Yeah. I mean, at a certain point, don't you want to have relationships with other people? And if everything you do is like, look, I'm a loner.
Right.
I mean, at a certain point, isn't that a little bit of a pose? I mean,
well, yes and no.
I mean, it seems a little bit just fantasy land if you're pretending that nobody else connects to you at all.
Right.
Or that you really don't need anybody for anything ever.
Or that you have nothing to learn from other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when I look back at some of this stuff, it's like, yeah, this is dicey stuff. But it was very present in my personality mm-hmm. and still is. Yeah.
I mean, I can't deny there's just something. There's a natural rush that I think a lot of people can get of thinking of, it's sort of empowering, and there's nothing wrong with empowering.
And I'm feeling empowered is good.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right that there's a balance. You shouldn't make yourself so empowered that you think nobody else is approachable.
Right. I'm the only one with access to the truth, and your vision of life is flawed. And I mean, yeah, that's, you can just disappear into your own ego. Yeah.
So on that note, let's play a song called No Ordinary Love.
Let's do it.
All right. So that was a nice big jump, both in terms of time and style, from the other two songs. By the way, this is so naive. Is it pronounced Sadie?
Sade. Oh, my gosh.
Sade?
Yeah.
Sade.
That reminds me of working at Blue Moon Gourmet Pizza, because Damon Watson ran a lot of Sade.
Ooh, that's a nice choice for a pizza place.
Yeah, we ran a lot of Sade.
Pizza place is very romantic.
So why No Ordinary Love by Sade? It was.
I don't know. I mean,
all right. Next, track.
Is there anybody that doesn't like Sade? I mean, Sade kind of. I mean, that track is from the early '90s, but Sade, starting in the early '80s, kind of starts to loom over a lot of what I was interested in. I shouldn't say a lot. That doesn't make sense. What I just said. I think that I'm really attracted to the Willie Nelson thing and the loner vibe. Yeah, but also I think that and Sade's similar. Sade, you're not going to see Sade on some reality TV show making herself look stupid.
Kind of distance from the
culture.
She's
not interested yet in that. But also she's super smooth.
Smooth
technically,
operator.
Absolutely. Technically, super proficient. So I think there was a way in which even if you're – again, you can kind of start to think of the individual vibe as being like also scruffy and deliberately avoiding too much polish. But I think when you listen to Sade, it's like, oh, polish. Polish isn't the problem. In fact, polish is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Like being masterful about exactly what you're doing has nothing to do with whether you are or not pursuing your individual creative vision. She's clearly pursuing her sound and her vision, and she's also completely polished, way more polished than any of us will ever be. And there, so I think that interests me as well.
And then, I mean, does this kind of tie into your own writing directly at all? I mean, from starting to now, I mean, was there a time where you were really against certain polished writers versus, I don't know, who were some of influences in terms of literary fiction? Like, were they kind of outsiders like Hunter S. Thompson? I mean, I don't think so, but versus polished people like, he's a very polished writer.
You know what we should do to destroy the binary thinking? We should talk about Hunter S. Thompson as totally polished.
Okay.
Because don't you think he is?
No.
Do I think Hunter S. Thompson was a very polished writer?
Yeah. As soon as you sit down, his voice, the voice of his writing, is totally locked in. Right? Yeah. It never wavers. Like, it's always that. It's super readable and it's super chatty, mm-hmm. but it's locked in. That's the voice, right? So that's not, I don't think that's an accident. That's mm-hmm. not like, I don't think Hunter just naturally, you know, took the right number of animal tranquilizers and then naturally produced that. Like, there's a lot of attention being paid there, and it's either him or an editor, him and an editor. Mm-hmm. But those Hunter S. Thompson pieces, like long magazine pieces he wrote in Rolling Stone or the Las Vegas book. What's the book called?
Leave Me. Oh.
Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Like, that stuff, those are, seem to me like they're just super locked in terms of how they're going to operate.
Mm-hmm. They always felt to me when I read it that oftentimes he was waiting for that moment when it was all clear and that it came out just right. But I have no idea how much time he spent editing and rewriting.
Right. Neither do I. Mm-hmm. But I think you can, again, to try and talk about how you can still pursue a vision that is outside a kind of commercialized mainstream, but you can still pursue it with a degree of focus and polish and care to where you're looking at how the sentence works and every sentence works and the way that I'm telling this story works, and that can be polished. And there's nothing magical about like avoiding polish and trying to.
So it depends on the definition of the word. Polish, I mean, can mean a variety of different things.
Yeah. Yeah, that. I guess at some level you could use other words like control. Is he in control of what he's doing?
Mm-hmm.
It seems like he's totally in control of what he's doing. I mean, I understand the persona is like, I've taken 5 different drugs and wild things happen. But I don't think the writing happened that way. Mm-hmm. It seems like he's totally in control of what he's doing.
Yeah, and he wrote a lot. I mean, he started as a journalist. And yeah, mm-hmm. Do you like his work at all? Not really.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, totally. Yeah,
but you don't read Hunter S. Thompson great. All the time, right?
Well, no, but I already read it. I mean,
you read it, so it's kind of it's.
Yeah, I've been thinking about reading *Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas* again because it's been a long time since I've read him.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I mean, he's a master.
Sure.
Yeah.
Colorado, right?
Yeah, he lived up in Colorado for a while, didn't he?
Yeah, he's from Kentucky, I think. Yeah. But.
He actually the last I don't know 10, 20 years of his life, he lived just out of. What's the really
Aspen.
Wealthy
outside Aspen. Of Aspen? No.
I know because I went to a music festival there, and it was famous with all the music students that where his house was, and there was a bar that he would randomly show up. So we would always go there,
right,
hoping to see him, but we never did.
When I lived in West Hollywood, people used to say, "Oh, did you know that Sade lives around here?" And
is that true?
Yeah, and they would say I lived near the Pacific Design Center, which is just a big conference center for designers, and. Mm-hmm. That neighborhood has a lot of design stores and furniture stores in it. And people would say, oh, I saw Sade the other day walking down the street. She's amazing. like so there was something similar where people were like, oh, the magic person lives around here.
Right.
And if you're in the right place at the right time, the magic person might walk past you.
Yeah.
And it's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeff mentioned Green Day earlier. I remember when I lived in LA being at some random burrito place and seeing a guy way down the sidewalk walking exactly like, what's his name, Billy, the lead singer?
Billy Joe Armstrong.
Walking exactly like him. I was like, that's weird that I recognize his walk. I watched him for like 5 minutes and he got to the place, came in the burrito place, and it was him.
Yeah.
And he was meeting the other two dudes from the band. I was like, this must be good burritos.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, we'll play something called The Strangest Thing. That was, if anyone doesn't know, George Michael.
I think some people might not know.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a very recognizable voice. But I don't think that's one of his more famous songs at all.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
Dan.
I'm not sure.
Well, anyway.
I mean, I know that from what I understand, his popularity in England and Europe is even higher than here. So maybe that could have been a huge hit over there. I'm not sure. I think you're right that maybe it wasn't a big deal here. Yeah.
But so why did you pick that song?
Yeah, why is that song meaningful to you?
It's probably redundant. I think George Michael's amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that probably similar stuff to what I was thinking about with Sade. Just a sense that this person is. I mean, he became famous for his struggles. I think, unfortunately, but well, he became famous for
Wham.
Yeah. But, I mean, the narrative of his life, I think everyone wants to, you have to include like his struggles. Mm-hmm. But in terms of his music, again, it's kind of the same thing where it's like he seemed to be in opposition to his record label. There were a number of years went by where he said, I'm not going to put any albums out because I'm trying to get out of my record contract because I don't like those people. And yet the whole time, whenever he put something out, it was like, this person is not ragged or out of control or scruffy, like the things he was creating are completely he's completely in control of what he's doing, and mm-hmm. he knows what he's doing. And I just the sound. Mm-hmm. I mean, it strikes me as something that other people would like to be able to make, but can't, that he could make.
I remember hearing that he's like, not just in control, but super, I don't know what the word is, just trying very hard. I remember seeing something on MTV or something when I was a teenager said he only wanted to be shot from the right side of his face or just the left side. Like, that's the level of control where he's like, only from this and this. And it's like,
well, people
whatever.
Know you have a better side. Everyone has right. a better side.
Right. I don't know what my better side is.
My better side is my left. Well, that's why Dan's looking at me from my left because I want him to. Yeah, I mean, I think George Michael's very honed and he has a very idiosyncratic thing. I mean, I don't know his work that well, but I mean, do you know when this came out or why this song in particular?
This came out, let me see, I actually have it written down. 1996.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
Why the song in particular? Oh, I don't know. It's just one I like, but I mean, I could have just said George Michael in general.
Okay.
Also, his sexuality was always an issue. Mm-hmm. And as a kid who played a lot of sports, a ton of basketball, I hung around with like real sporty jockey mm-hmm. guys a lot. Mm-hmm. And I probably would have to kind of keep it on the down low that. Yeah. I really liked George Michael Sade, mm-hmm. frankly. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was kind of an early lesson in recognizing that I admired and was interested in art that was created by all sorts of people and that sexuality, for whatever reason, was going to be something that if I ever said to someone, God, have you heard the latest George Michael track? It's amazing. Like that the first thing they would think about me is like that reflected upon my sexuality. Mm-hmm. And I think that lasted for a long time where I was like, am I as a straight basketball playing high school kid, am I allowed to like George Michael? Mm-hmm. Like you kind of understood that maybe you weren't supposed to, but you also couldn't figure out why. Like I knew why, because then people were going to say that you were gay and then that was bad. But I think early on, that was one of the other things that was like that desire to kind of be your own person. Which I think a lot of times, if you think back to the Robert Redford movie or whatever, is presented as this rugged masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that I was like drawing, I was finding people all over the place that were their own people. And it had nothing to do with whether you're like ruggedly masculine riding a horse in the American West, or if you're a gay British guy that making kind of super smooth music. I don't know. It was all over the place.
And you were finding these things in no discernible order. I mean, it was just kind of the way you were moving through your life. It wasn't.
Yeah.
I mean, because I grew up skateboarding and I was on the basketball team. And I mean, that same thing in a different Western town. I mean, I'm a little bit mm-hmm. younger than you. But knowing that you would be judged not on your music selection, but on other things. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I've always listened to George Michael just because he seemed to me to be self-evidently ultra talented and making. His music always seemed very personal, and I respected that. I thought that was really interesting. But I also had a sense that anytime you said to someone, well, I'm kind of a big George Michael fan, that it had this extra meaning at some level.
The cultural connotation for certain people, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I remember when Elton John came out, and it was such a huge... Actually, I don't know
when
if
he
I should...
came out?
Yeah. Well, maybe I shouldn't say I remember, because maybe it was before I was...
Yeah, it was in...
too young. But I remember reading about it or hearing about it, that when he came out, it almost ruined his career time.
When did Elton John come out? I thought it was like the 70s.
Maybe it was. So obviously for me to say I remember is not honest. But
no, I think he didn't come out until the 80s.
Okay.
Yeah.
But obviously we still have a long way to go as a society, but it's not as bad now, I don't think.
No, I don't think so.
I hope not.
I bet the George Michael biopic that comes out in 3 years is going to be great.
Oh, is there going to be one?
No, I just assume. Okay. There's always, I can.
Right.
Well, let's hear a Brian Eno track. Thank you. It's called An Ending, and then in parentheses, Ascent.
Brian Eno.
Brian Eno.
Do you ever listen to Brian Eno while writing?
Yes.
Do you listen to music while writing?
About half the time. But when I do, it would be something like that, or classical music that doesn't have any words.
So yeah, no lyrics or anything?
Yeah. Yeah. And I did the album that's from. I used to listen to that album quite a bit while writing. Yeah.
Which album is it?
It's called Apollo.
Why? Yeah, I mean, I like Brian Eno a lot. In a Landscape and Discreet. I don't know. I know.
Sure, he's got a ton of.
He's got a ton of albums. Yeah. What's your relationship with him? Why that?
I think that he does something that's really difficult for. If we're trying to keep this conversation today about the relationship between writing and music, there's some things music can do that writing can't do, and I think that Eno does some things with music or soundscapes or whatever you want to call them that as a writer you wish that you could do, and maybe you're hoping that if your writing is working well, it's creating a certain emotional effect in the reader, but you're never going to get to know that, whether what it feels like to be the reader. So I think by listening to music like that, you're kind of accessing an idealized state that you would like writing to be able to achieve, but really writing can't achieve that state, I don't think. I mean, what is the is there an analog in writing to like a synthesizer? I don't think that there is.
Maybe a metaphor?
Okay.
No, I don't know. I mean, I guess I've never thought about that. But I mean, when you listen to that, Brian, you know, I mean, you think it's the representation of an idealized musical state because it's serene.
Yeah, and at some level, it's spiritual, right?
It's sound, yeah.
Yeah. And so it's about, it's the sound or of something, a state that's beyond the state you're in your everyday life.
Well, what's the Walter Pater quote that all art, you know what I'm talking about? All art aspires to be the condition of music.
Yeah.
We'll edit this out and we'll have me saying it, correctly. But all art aspires to music or something along those lines.
Right.
Yeah.
And art, there are some art forms that have aspects of themselves where they're not representative. You know, you could do abstract expressionist painting.
Mm-hmm.
And music can often be a thing where it's not representative, right? You can't say.
Right.
Whereas I think for writing, that's a real struggle because when you're using language, every word has a meaning. It's very difficult to get writing into a state, to produce a state that feels like an abstract higher truth that's not. You understand what I mean?
I do. I mean, I thought immediately of like Gertrude Stein, like Tender Buttons when she was writing in cubist kind of painting forms. And that's... I mean, everyone loves Tender Buttons. I like Tender Buttons. It's not everyone's cup of tea, you know.
Right.
For some people, it's just too much to a certain degree.
Right.
But I think different writers have tried in different ways. But, I mean, it's very different than that song that we just listened to, I guess.
Right, right.
And, the different musicalities of what you're kind of going for. Because some writing, I mean, it really wants to be discordant, right? It doesn't want to sound like that Brian Eno song.
Oh, no, sure. Right.
But... I mean, that Brian Eno song, I think, for a variety of listeners, does sound very pleasant, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And also meaningful.
Right. Yeah, it's not really...
like, no, I mean,
it's not wallpaper.
That might sound glib. I mean, it does sound meaningful.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Sonny?
Well, I'm still thinking about your first question, which I really liked, which was what's the analog to a synthesizer in writing? And the opposite. It froze. It got me going. Like, what is that? And I was just thinking, essentially, the synthesizer is any other instrument. It's just a tool. And I wondered, because I've read interviews with writers who talk about how they wrote before computers, when they would type up everything, and how their writing changed now with the computer. And I was wondering maybe... those are the way to talk about if we wanted to compare synthesizer, the way the technology affects us now. Because it can be really interesting. I never wrote on a typewriter. I don't consider myself young, but I'm not old enough to have done that. But when I read about writers that did, they're surprised how their writing wasn't necessarily slower. It just put them in a different frame of mind.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever write on anything besides the computer?
No.
Okay.
My family had a typewriter when I was a kid, but it was unused in a cabinet.
Do you ever write with a pen or pencil?
Yes.
Okay.
Quite often.
And what makes you choose between that and typing?
Looking at the screen on Microsoft Word, you're presented with this kind of this fake piece of paper.
Yeah.
Everything you type is shown to you as if it's a final thing,
mm-hmm.
with typography and the piece of paper. And I think that when I'm trying to write something that I know is not the final thing,
mm-hmm.
when I'm trying to work on some language or play around with some ideas, constantly having it shown to me like, this is what it looks like, I don't like that.
Yeah, I almost always, on my first round of writing something, I have to start with paper because mm-hmm. I feel way more free to doodle,
yeah.
draw ideas, make an arrow, like put this up there.
Yes.
And I totally relate to what you said. When it's on a screen, it makes me uncomfortable because I know that line I just wrote isn't final, but it makes it appear that way.
Yeah. Yeah. It kind of shames you right away with like, this is what you just wrote looks like. Do you really want that? whereas the notebook never shames you. The notebook's like, yeah, just fill me up. Keep on going.
Yeah. They're nicer.
Yeah.
All right. One more song. And actually, sorry, two more songs.
Cannot change. In the hills, deep off in the main. Eminem, sweet like candy cane. Drop the top, pop it, let it bang. For this life, I cannot change. In the hills, deep off in the main. Eminem, sweet like candy cane. Drop the top, pop it, let it bang. Pop it, drop the top, play hide and seek. Jump inside. Jump straight to the lead. Take a sip, feel just how I be. On freeway, but no, ain't nothing free.
So that was Butterfly Effect by Travis Scott. When did you get into Travis Scott?
My son got me into Travis Scott.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not the only writer that we've heard that their son or their kids get them into the current, often hip-hop.
Yeah.
Because it feels like, I was talking to someone else, that it feels like these days, not much good music is being made except hip-hop. And maybe that's just...
I would disagree with that.
All right. What was good, Jeff, that was made this year?
What was good that was made in February the new Sharon Van Etten album's really good. I mean, I don't know. There's a whole sorts of things that are really good.
All right. Well, anyway, I'm getting off topic.
That are non-hip-hop?
Yeah. Mean,
What does our guest think? Dan, do you think?
Did you listen to the Cat Power album that came out a few months ago? Oh, my gosh.
Is it really good?
It's so good.
It's spare, right?
Yeah, but amazing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's some good stuff, Sonny. Don't give up.
I'm often wrong. I'm used to that state.
So is your son a big Travis Scott fan? Is he a big fan?
He's a big Travis Scott fan.
In hip-hop generally or just Travis Scott specifically?
I think he listens to a lot of hip-hop. I wouldn't pretend to know everything he listens to because they have headphones on all the time. But his generation, so it's not like they're blasting the music
right.
like boombox. But yeah, he listens to a lot of hip-hop, I think.
And you are very open to listening to things that came out. I mean, just now, or I don't know. Some people have rap is crap things still in their head. Like,
No, I'm totally open to listening to stuff. He plays a lot of good stuff for me that I would never otherwise have stumbled across. But it's interesting. I mean, I think I included the Travis Scott because I did want to include something where it's like, oh, I recognize this energy. And here's the thing. This isn't mine.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I think of the Willie Nelson song, it's like, oh, that's from my childhood and it's some way I can identify with it. When I listen to that Travis Scott song, I'll listen to that song when I'm driving around town in my car and I'll love it. But if I'm dropping one of my kids off somewhere, they will turn the volume down before they open the door to get out of the car. And I totally understand why. It's because it's like, that's not yours to be blasting.
Sure.
You're stealing from a different generation. And for me, it's like, yeah, but I understand the energy. I totally recognize this energy.
Right.
I've always been into this energy. What are you talking about? But I also understand it's like, yeah, we need to turn the volume down before I open this door, because you do not want my friends to hear that my dad is listening to Travis Scott while he drives to get groceries. This is gross.
I can understand that, yeah.
Yeah.
But when you say this energy, I mean, what does the energy sound like? It's just kind of buoyancy? Something.
Well, if you think about a lot of what we've been listening to, and if I had to analyze it, I do think that, and also I should say, I'm not like up to date on who's cool and who's not in hip hop this week.
Okay.
So I know Travis Scott just played the Super Bowl.
That's true.
And I understand that that was maybe not the coolest thing for him to do. And that, so I might be like admiring a person right now who's officially out. I don't know. I won't pretend to know. But I do sense in that track a kind of combination of that smooth control that we're hearing in like George Michael and Sade, but also with a kind of like bravado and outsider. Mm-hmm. He's not really an outsider at all. But
I mean, a lot of hip hop artists.
Outside of maybe mainstream culture, right?
Sure.
Like it's someone who's like, I'm not a part of this country's main thing that I'm seeing on TV every night. But here's what I do. Like, there's a way in which he has both of these qualities.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, when I listen to that, I'm like, this is masterful. I think I love this track.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that it definitely gave me the same feeling as some of the early music. Even though the styles are so different, it gave me the same feeling of empowerment and the same feeling of individuality. That, of course, you have to check yourself and be like, well, I do need other people. But it's nice sometimes to feel bigger than you are.
And I was talking with about this recently, that I'm from a generation that has kind of like memorized a lot of the personality types of the Briggs-Myers test.
Oh, really? Okay.
So I use the term oppositional defiant a lot, mm-hmm. because that's a Briggs-Myers personality type.
What does that mean?
Oppositional defiant is just like the person that if you tell them to do something, will do the opposite. Oh. And if you tell them how things are done around here, they won't do it that way. Mm. And that's like supposedly a personality type. And I've always used that term and in a way to be like, you know, I recognize that I have certain aspects of myself that are oppositional defiant. And if someone,
that you yourself do.
Oh, yeah. Okay. If someone's like, look, here's the way that you should do this, I will immediately start trying to figure out ways to do it differently.
Okay. That. Sure, sure.
Are you consciously aware of that in the moment?
I am at this age.
Okay.
I think when I was younger, I wasn't aware of it. I just thought that's what creative was. Mm-hmm. Like when someone says, let's do it this way, then what I would do is try and figure out a different way to do it that was mm-hmm. better than the way that they said. And
I can imagine that got you into trouble a lot.
No, because Sonny always pulled it off.
Oh, really? Wow.
There we go.
I'm just saying that. But okay. I'm just staying in character.
Oh, okay.
as oppositional defiant.
As oppositional defiant, right. And the loner who's going to probably going to save that horse.
Right.
Right? And everybody says that I'm going to get caught, but I'm not.
Wait, so oppositional defiant came up in relation, though.
Well, I was thinking recently that label, I don't like that label anymore because it implies that there's something that you're opposing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of people just want to try and be themselves, figure out who they are, and pursue what they're interested in life. And they're not really opposing anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that obstacles get shoved in their way. And then when they want to push those obstacles to the side or try and maintain focus on the thing that they were trying to focus on, then they get labeled as like the person that won't kind of play along and the person. Like, I think oppositional defiant is it's a judgmental label for people who might not be opposing anything so much as they just have interests that are not kind of the standard interests.
It might even be more common than we realize. I remember reading a study about playground designers,
yeah.
And they found that no matter what they put on the playground, kids' instinct was to use it not in the way. They want to go up the slide always.
Right.
Always.
Yes. And so that's not oppositional. It's not like a kid was like, you know what? I'm so tired of these playground designers. I want to teach these playground designers a thing or two about play. That's not what that is, right? They're not defiant of anything. Mm-hmm. They just happen to want to move this way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I don't know why I'm talking about. Oh, I guess I'm talking about that because with the Travis Scott track, it's like, oh, you were talking about rap, Jeff. Like, is rap somehow, people often talk about it as being like somehow defiant, or that these the rappers are rough, or they use too much bad language. But the reality is that maybe this is what they're interested in. Like, this is the kind of music they like to make, and they enjoy this. It's not defiant of of anything in particular.
Mm-hmm.
They're not opposing you. They're making music they enjoy.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I think with my favorite hip hop artists, and I think a lot, like, they let the world come to them rather than go running to the world.
And isn't that at some and level think, a kind of like a standard move for yeah. people trying to make art, right?
I mean, sure. Yeah.
I know you're into Biggie.
Biggie, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a person who's like, look, I'm not the thing that's like the mainstream attraction. For someone like Biggie, it's like, I'm not beautiful in your standard way. I'm not from a place that's kind of like the supposedly cool place. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to do my thing, and I'm going to do it so well that eventually you'll realize, actually,
yeah,
we need to come to him.
The mainstream is him. Yeah.
Yeah.
So sure. Yeah.
Yeah. He's not opposed. He's not defying anyone. He's just doing his thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Same with, I guess, Travis Scott, who I don't know well.
Yeah,
well
no, but I don't know. This all could be totally fake. We could totally be off, too.
How about some George Frideric Handel?
Yeah.
All right. I think it's interesting that you ended with Handel, because, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but he was, I think, the teacher of Mozart, who was one of the first huge individuals in their world of music, whereas Handel himself was still in the world of, like, he would be in the employment of some royal monarch. Mm. And Mozart, I think, was the first one to break out of that and be like, I'm going to be an individual and not be under anyone's control.
Huh. Yeah, I didn't know that. I didn't think about that. Yeah.
Why did you choose the song?
Because I watched the Kubrick movie Barry Lyndon recently.
Good movie.
Yeah. Fantastic movie. And that track is repeated. That piece is repeated a lot in that movie. Mm-hmm. And I put it last for this discussion, because I'm interested in this track quite a bit right now. But when I was trying to think about these things analytically, which is really dangerous, I mean, you're making me put into words what should just be intuitive.
Okay.
And I'm also hyper-conscious of the fact that three white guys just spent 5 minutes discussing Travis Scott way where I'm sure some people are like, you guys need to just shut it down.
Yeah,
right?
It was only 5 minutes.
Yeah, but I think that what I like about that Handel piece, and it's totally influenced by the movie, mm-hmm. is that... I think as I've gotten older, the things that we talked about earlier, which is like this being drawn toward the kind of the loner and being drawn toward having a kind of mastery over what you're doing, but doing your own thing so well on your own, that as you get older, you realize that there are comical aspects of that,
mm-hmm.
like that there are delusions you're indulging in. And that maybe you should learn how to work with other people, and that maybe your kind of solitudinous mastery is worth very little, because we all die eventually anyway. Mm-hmm. So congratulations on all the time you spend with your solitudinous mastery. Like I think that Kubrick movie has a tone in it, and so I'm hearing that when I listen to the piece. So I'm not sure if that's originally in the piece, but I sense a kind of grim determination to just repeat this beautiful thing over and over and over. And there's a way in which it starts to be simultaneously like beautiful and willful and also funny, where you have a sense that these this energy, this super intensity, you can get some perspective on it. And the perspective on it is that super intensity is often pretty comical.
Hmm.
But you can have the perspective, you can laugh at it, without like resolving it or getting rid of it in some kind of psychological way, what you can do is you can retain that intensity and you can retain that commitment to trying to be totally in control of what you're doing with your creativity, with your art. And then you can also have a perspective that's like, also at the end of the day, I'm going to die anytime, so it doesn't really matter. And that's funny. It's funny that I continue to have these personality qualities and I recognize that there's some delusions involved in them and some ego involved in them. And I think that's funny. Also, I'm not going to get rid of them. Right. So I do hear that. I think mostly because of the Kubrick movie. The movie has one of those tones Kubrick's so good at, which is like, is this movie ultra dramatic or is this movie funny?
Yeah.
And it's both at the same time, because there's a way in which the just total commitment to in that movie to like moving higher in society, mm-hmm. and the way in which that commitment is not abandoned becomes over time just comical.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
But it's both things at once, right?
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to describe Kubrick, because they're so intense, but there's a point where it just seems absurd and I want to laugh. And it actually heightens my enjoyment of it.
Yeah, and you can play, I mean, I feel like you can play that track and you can say almost anything over it, mm-hmm. and it becomes funny. Like, you should say really serious things over the track, like, you know, and then in 2019, Jeff and Sonny began the podcast. And then if it's playing over that, it gives things. And, yeah. And Jeff Alessandrelli decided that he would move back to Portland.
That's
and he would begin a new stage in his creative life with his friend Sonny.
Wow.
The podcast would be a new podcast.
Okay.
An innovative podcast that would end all other podcasts.
This is the greatest episode we've ever made.
Yeah, we finally got some plugs.
I'm so glad that you came in and talked to us, Dan.
It has been a pleasure.
Yes. Jeff, any parting words?
Dan, do you like Guns N' Roses?
I do not like Guns N' Roses.
Okay.
Does anybody like Guns N' Roses?
Well, in Dan's latest novel, a character finds them comically bad, so I was just curious. Do you like Air Supply?
I do not like Air Supply, but I find Air Supply to be of equal quality as Guns N' Roses.
One last question. Did you grow up with Black Sabbath in your life or not?
No.
Okay.
No Black Sabbath until I was probably late high school when I realized that that was a thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's all for me.
We're all just going to float out of this studio.
Gentlemen, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you,
Dan.
You're listening to The Steer, recorded at KBOO Radio, broadcast on dublab.com, hosted by Jeff Alessandrelli and Sonny Bleckinger. For more, see our website at www.the-steer.com. You can download our episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, and anywhere podcasts are found.